Welcome to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. And we begin the hour with a question. Are real estate buyers and lenders ignoring the rising threat climate change poses in Florida? One scientist says yes.
Yeah, an expert on the impact of climate change on financial markets says no one should get 30-year mortgages anymore in the entire state of Florida. Imagine that. He says eventually making a home loan for 30 years here in the Sunshine State will just be too risky.
Now, Spencer Glendon of the Woods Hole Research Institute made these remarks, Tom, at an investor conference in New York last week. So here's a question, Florida. Are you looking for a home? Looking to sell, maybe? Is climate change and the higher cost of living here maybe driving your decision? What are your questions about this? Give us a call right now on the Florida Roundup at 305-995-1800 or tweet us at Florida Roundup. We will get to those calls and tweets in a moment, so get on the line now. But first, Glendon says financial institutions are going to wreck Florida's economy if they don't confront the risk to coastal real estate and quickly change their ways. I spoke with him yesterday. Spencer Glendon, thanks so much for being with us.
Yes, my pleasure.
You made a lot of waves recently when you sounded the alarm about real estate lenders and investors in Florida. You say are ignoring the rising threat that climate change poses here, specifically when it comes to providing mortgages at 30-year lengths of time, which is the typical amount of time, and by buying long-term debt. You're saying this could pose financial calamity for Florida. Can you explain in a little more detail what your research shows around this issue?
Sure. So what I'm trying to help people understand is that what maybe seem like a long time horizon or something that's far away actually isn't far away, because we make lots of decisions in our everyday lives that seem short term. But the foundation of society, of modern life, is a set of assumptions. And the one that I think is easiest to get people to understand is the 30-year mortgage. So it's the foundation of the housing market. It's also 30 years is the time horizon on which the U.S. government often borrows, and it's often used for municipal bonds for things like sewer systems and water purification and electricity supply, things like that, hospitals. And anytime there's a 30-year debt, and the mortgage is the easiest example again, there's a set of provisions within the 30-year debt that 30-year debt will be violated if you breach some condition. And so the condition that I think will be breached in Florida is that of insurability. So you have a lot of places in Florida that are increasingly under risk of flooding, and they're increasingly under risk of having a kind of erosion of the infrastructure that Florida depends on because the ocean is rising and because it's warmer and because the air is warmer. So let me give you a couple of specific examples. When you have a 30-year mortgage for your home, you have a condition that you need to have insurance. That insurance isn't for 30 years, though. It's renewed annually. And at any point in time, the insurers can say, actually, we're no longer offering insurance where you are. That's a very real risk. And as I talk to both insurance companies and reinsurance companies, that is the companies that insure the retail insurance companies, they say increasingly, we're not going to be in these markets.
They're telling you we're not going to be in these markets, i.e. the Florida market, right?
That's right.
So I guess the question I have and many other Floridians have is, when does that happen? When does that tipping point occur?
Things that are a 1 in 20 year event or a 5% risk are essentially uninsurable in most parts of the world. That's too often for an insurance company to want to intervene and have to deal with claims, and it's too often for them to have faith that the borrower, in this case the insurer, will act accordingly. And so insurance markets dry up once things become more than a 1 or 2% chance. In most of Florida, I think that's most of coastal Florida, that threshold's already been breached. And so I think that any day, insurance could dry up in many places for flooding, for nuisance flooding in particular. But more importantly, that should be relevant for new buyers. So the Florida economy is largely built on the promise of continued in-migration. And when new buyers arrive, they need to borrow for an additional 30 years. And what I think will actually dry up is the supply of loans will dry up in anticipation of when the insurance will dry up. So as long as we know that insurance will dry up with any confidence in the next 20 years, today no one should lend for 30. And once there aren't 30-year loans available on a regular basis, whether they're from Fannie Mae or a traditional bank, the Florida property market will be in trouble.
You're describing a cascading, spiraling effect that could pull Florida's economy, honestly, into a tailspin. If mortgagers refuse to write a 30-year mortgage, if insurers refuse to insure, if the real estate market collapses, creating, you know, a ripple effect into other industries, other pillars of the economy. This, as you said, this is a state built on tourism and real estate and growth and development. And so your warning is dire enough that it has gotten a lot of attention in the national media. At the same time, what's so remarkable here in Florida, Dr. Glendon, is that most of the players in this space are proceeding as though it's just business as usual. What about that?
It's a remarkable thing. And I'm doing this work not because I want bad things to happen in Florida. Indeed, quite the opposite. I would like it to be the case that people start preparing now, because the cascade you describe is exactly right. Florida is especially vulnerable with zero income tax. It depends overly on real estate relative to most places and on construction.
Okay, so if Florida is especially vulnerable due to all these factors and people should start preparing now, what should the average homeowner that's listening to you right now, or someone who's thinking about buying a property in Florida, how should we prepare?
I think that living in Florida probably remains a viable option for a long time. How long exactly is unclear. And so with only a few feet of rise of sea level, you'll have real problems in all of Florida. People should start preparing for that. The one way to prepare is not to take debt on it, pay down their mortgages and or sell. I wish it weren't the case that everyone should sell, but renting in Florida makes perfect sense. Owning in Florida makes much less. The other is that it's a huge political problem. You see, as the ocean gets higher, it gets heavier and it infiltrates the land. Florida is principally made up of porous limestone, and the aquifers on which Floridians depend are starting to become saline. And actually, as one of your former governors told me in person, almost all the toilets flush into the ocean. And as the ocean gets higher, it puts more pressure on those sewage systems. Those municipalities are going to have to prepare for a much more challenging physical environment. And so I think that climate change and adaptation should be a local issue, a congressional issue, a government, a statewide governor issue. And Florida should be asking the U.S. government and others in the country to start preparing both in terms of mitigation, lowering CO2 emissions down to zero, and adaptation.
And some municipalities are going after that more aggressively than others here in Florida. As you just said, you don't think 30-year mortgages should be written in this state anymore. You think people who can sell their homes should sell their homes. What happens, though, if people come to this kind of belated realization and they all start trying to sell their homes at once? Who's going to want to buy them?
Well, part of the reason for me to do this work is that the longer we wait to start this process, the messier it will certainly be. The population of Florida has gone up enormously in the last two decades, with people investing in that place and new infrastructure going in right at the coast. In fact, in many ways, Florida has become more coastal over the last 20 years, which is quite amazing in the face of the fact that the ocean is coming to greet them by rising itself. And so part of the reason for me to do this work publicly is to make people understand the sooner we start the process of unwinding some of these misallocated capital, the less painful it will be. I'm sorry that climate change is going to be painful for many people, and I don't think there will be many winners at all. But if we start acknowledging some of the misplaced capital now and misplaced expectations now, the adjustment will be easier. The longer we wait to start adjusting, the more painful it will be.
Spencer Glendon, PhD, a climate research analyst with the Woods Hole Research Center. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Climate risk, climate cost, and real estate. Is it affecting your neighborhood? Is it affecting where you live now, where you would like to live in the next decade? How is your home insured? How has that insurance changed? 305-995-1800, our statewide phone number, 305-995-1800, or at Florida Roundup on Twitter. Kevin McCarty knows a thing or two about insuring the homes of Floridians. He served as the state's insurance commissioner for 13 years, regulating the industry through the busy storm years of 2004 and 5. You remember those storms, Katrina, Wilma, Charlie, and others. He's the chairman today of the Florida Association for Insurance Reform, and he joins us via FaceTime from Tallahassee. Mr. McCarty, welcome to Florida Public Radio. Thanks for your time today. Is a 30-year home mortgage a fool's bargain in Florida today?
Well, that's difficult to conclude based upon the information we have right now. You know, it wasn't that long ago after 2004 and 5 that the reinsurance market dried up, and many people believe we wouldn't be able to have traditional insurance in Florida. But, you know, the marketplace settled out. We had an influx of capital after the financial crisis, largely due to the influx of capital for insurance-linked securities, which provided another, you know, avenue for mm-hmm. funding. So it's difficult to say with any certainty that, you know, give up on Florida because, you know, there's no capital to support, you know, the continuing growth. You know, it certainly does raise an issue that Florida needs to be cognizant of in terms of rising sea levels.
The previous guest's point was less about insurance, saying that there will probably still exist to be the ability to have insurance. To pay for it is another question, but it's the supply of mortgages. Banks just may not be willing to lend to a buyer who is buying a property in the state of Florida.
Well, I mean, that's interesting to me because there's a huge number of homes in California that are provided mortgages that they don't have earthquake coverage. There are, you know, millions and millions of dollars worth of mortgage property in California that are on fault lines that don't have, simple protection of an earthquake coverage. We know earthquakes are going to happen mm-hmm. in California. It's not if, but when. And when it happens, it will be devastating. Yet the mortgage industry continues to provide mortgages in California. I would say that you can certainly look at that in the same way. I mean, there is, unless something happens dramatically to shift the burden to the banks to actually have to pay for that, they haven't had to in the past.
So, Mr. Picard, let me ask you, I mean, the average mortgage in the United States, while it's lent for 30 years, actually only lasts about 5 or 7 years. Commercial right. mortgages, when these real estate developers look to develop oceanfront or waterside property, which is the most expensive and thus has the most reward, also the most risk, those loans tend to be 3 or 5 years in time. Are the incentives just wrong right now in terms of real estate in the state of Florida when it comes to acknowledging in a real way and really addressing the true risk of climate change, because that risk is 30, 40, 50 years down the line?
Well, I think it's fair to say that Florida as a state has not sufficiently addressed the issue of rising water as a result of climate change. I think there have been some efforts made at the local level, particularly in Southeast Florida. Mm-hmm. Miami Beach in particular has made, you know, a Herculean effort to pump water and build an infrastructure in response to that. But you're right. We continue, thousands of people continue to move to Florida weekly and continue to add to the insurable risk in Florida. And that risk is, and a lot of that, is, as our previous guest said, is concentrated within 50 miles of the coast.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that tends to be the more attractive area, which it defies the logic when it comes to the potential for disaster from rising water.
So speaking with Kevin McCarty, the former insurance commissioner here in the state of Florida, talking about climate change and property, your phone calls at 305-995-1800 coming up in just a moment here. But Kevin, I wanted to ask you, finally, we're on the eve of another storm season. Insurance rates in the state of Florida, some I know are going to call in and argue with this, but have been relatively stable, even with Hurricane Irma and Hurricane Michael and Hurricanes Matthew and Hermine over the last couple of sessions, because there's lots of money that's willing to take the risk still in Florida. What's going to change that risk scenario, though?
Well, I mean, it came about very quickly. It came as a result of the financial crisis because, you know, people decided that things risk weren't as non-correlated. And hurricane risk in Florida created a huge influx of money for that to back that. So right now, there hasn't been any. No storm has really made that difference. But yes, you can certainly see a series of storms or events that happen over a protracted period of time that make and if the other thing, if interest rates go up, because the interest rates have been so low that money has been flowing into this, and that's been another factor.
Yeah, it's the flow of international money into Florida willing to take on that risk, Melissa. Lots of phone calls here. 305-995-1800 is the phone number.
No surprise, so many people have questions about their property, their long-term risk, the value of their homes, or their commercial property. Let's go to some of your calls right now here on the Florida Roundup, beginning with Patrick in Tampa. Hey, Patrick, thanks for your call. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for having me. I was just calling to say that I think that the insurance situation has already actually happened to my parents. So they moved here way back in 1991, and they had a mortgage that they've now paid off. But during that time, insurance has, of course, gone up. But it's gone up to the point where they can't afford it anymore. So now they're sitting in their house. The mortgage is paid off,
But it's not insurable.
Are they
in a low-lying area? Are they in a flood-prone area?
It's kind of. It's on Merritt Island, so it's not like technically low-lying, but it's on an island. So yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, I guess the thing I'm wondering is like, you know, what are we gonna go from here? Because like right now they're just kind of sitting in their house hoping that, you know, nothing horrible happens.
Sure.
And yeah.
Yeah, Patrick, I hear you. Like, and, you know, I own a home in Florida myself. I think so many of us have these questions. And so for Patrick's parents, that's Patrick in Tampa. Thank you for that call. Okay, Kevin McCarty, our insurance expert here. This is the scenario homeowners are worried about and some are already experiencing, that they will simply lose insurability, that they will not be able to secure insurance for their home, which will make it impossible to sell. What answer can we give these folks? And what sort of contingency plans do you think the state should be making to get out in front of this? Because as we heard from our previous guest, he's advising we get out in front of this more aggressively than we are here in Florida.
Well, I mean, when it comes to the issue of rising sea levels, there's no question that, you know, the state has not made the a comprehensive effort to address that. But if you're looking at the insurability, and you go back to your original question about insurability, you know, I think we look back to 2006, and the two biggest issues on the political campaign were the rising costs of insurance and the rising costs of property taxes. And, you know, insurance was one of the top issues on the minds of consumers, and it drove that governor's election and a number of the elections. And I think that's why they expanded the CAT fund to address that at that time. As we have already said, a lot of capital is in the market right now. We haven't seen that kind of rate instability or lack of capital that would create the kind of problem you're talking about. That doesn't mean it can't happen, absolutely. And that's why things need to be done to make our communities more resilient and therefore more insurable in the voluntary market.
Kevin McCarty is the former insurance commissioner here in the state of Florida. Today, he is the chairman of the Florida Association for Insurance Reform. Kevin, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Insurability, livability, the cost of living near or on the coast. That's what we're talking about, the cost of climate change and your home or your apartment. Have you sold your home and are a renter in Florida because of the climate? 305-995-1800. More from the Florida Roundup after this.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. The Memorial Day weekend just ahead of us. It is going to be a hot one here in Florida. The hurricane storm season, of course, begins in a week. We've already seen that first named storm. It lasted less than a day, but it is still an awful reminder, of course, the months ahead.
Yeah, and every year they're coming earlier and earlier, Tom, which is not encouraging. you know, we don't like to see that. But this week, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration forecast an almost normal, whatever we can call that in terms of the percentage of storms, but a busy Atlantic hurricane season. Here's NOAA forecaster Jerry Bell.
9 to 15 named storms is a lot. 4 to 8 hurricanes is a lot. 2 to 4 major hurricanes is a lot. So the key message is We're expecting a near normal season, but regardless, that's a lot of activity. You need to start getting prepared for the hurricane season now.
And of course, all Floridians know the mantra, it only takes one, right? So how is the threat of storms, stronger storms, more rain, more frequent rain, all of this affecting your cost of living? Is insurance getting too expensive for your home? Can you even get insurance? Do you want to have insurance but can't afford it? 305-995-1800. 305-995-1800 at Florida Roundup on Twitter. More of your phone calls here. We will continue in the panhandle. Alex is there. Alex, I imagine you've got some very recent experience with Hurricane Michael in the panhandle.
Yes, sir, and thank you for taking my call. Actually, I'm in Apalachicola, Florida, and we're still dealing with Hurricane Michael, of course. Our infrastructure, Highway 98, goes right along the coast there. So, as a potential first-time buyer, I'm sort of nervous as can I even leave my home or get to my home, and, you know, with our infrastructure down still from, you know, 6 years ago. It's a little nerve-wracking. I'm wondering what our state is prepared to do with that, especially with the highway right along the coast.
Yeah, great question. I mean, where are you in the purchase process?
We're hopefully, or it's about to close last week, but it's been postponed. But
So you've got your insurance and any flood insurance already lined up, Alex?
No, sir. We're not in a flood zone, so that's another issue with the rising seas. Potentially we need maybe beachfront sooner or later.
I'll tell you what, when you talk to people that stress the importance of flood insurance, they will say, in effect, the whole state is a flood zone.
Right.
Even if
right.
you're not in one officially, they recommend you get that flood insurance policy anyway. $500 or $600 can save you hundreds of thousands of dollars. So if you can, I'd say get that flood insurance, even though, you know, it might seem like an unnecessary outlay.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, the other issue is the industry here is mainly seafood, so we're not the richest county, Franklin County, as such as, like, Dade County or Miami. So, you know, it's taken a long time even to recover, and we don't make a lot up in the panhandle, so... we're pinching pennies almost.
Sure.
As well,
so. Yeah. And I hear it.
Well, thanks, Alex.
Thank you, Alex, for that. And lots of calls on this. Let's go to Renee in Miami Lakes. Hey, Renee, you're on the Florida Roundup. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. So I recently bought a home about 3 years ago. I would say recent. I've done some major upgrades because I'm thinking about making this like as much as a fortress as I can, obviously. With the last hurricane that came by, everyone was going up north. And, you know, it would take like 8 hours to get to Orlando, and so forth. So, with all this investment that's done, on everyone's homes, and then you have what was once not a flood zone, now a flood zone. Now I'm even thinking about getting one of these things that kind of surrounds the house and you make it kind of like a little island, if you will.
Like a bulkhead?
A large rubber tube, if you will, that goes around the house and it's filled with water.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of keeps water away. But my question is, if I'm inland, how likely is it that I'm going to be impacted by rising seas if I'm, 5 miles or 8 miles inland?
Sure. Well, I'll tell you, what I would recommend that you do, Renee, is you can assess the danger of flooding and water damage to your property on a number of different websites. There's one really good one that I like called floodiq.com. Just go to that website. Floodiq.com. Go to that website,
okay.
Type in your address, and you can look at projections 5 years from now, 10 years, 15 years, looking at the impact of severe storms like a hurricane and the flooding that can result from that on your piece of property. And that, I think, is a good tool. And there are some other tools like that on the internet as well. Climate Central has a similar widget, but that can kind of help you get a feel for how much of a risk you've got on at your address. So I hope that's helpful.
And one more question. So let's say, at this point, if there's going to be so much possible flooding all over the country,
where do we go?
Exactly. I know. That's what keeps me up at night. I know. Oh, Renee, yeah. you're reading my mind too. It's true.
But Renee's kind of question points out that the sea level rise and climate change is not only along the shoreline here
That's
in the state
right.
of Florida,
That's
given
right.
that we're built on a Swiss cheese of limestone where water is going to come up from below, even if you're miles and miles away from the coastline. Charles in Orlando, our last call on this, but you're trying to get into the housing market as a homeowner. Charles, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm a recent college graduate here around the Orlando area, and I'm actually getting ready to sign a 30-year mortgage for a high-rise downtown Orlando. So,
For a condominium or the whole building, Charles?
For a condominium.
Okay,
that's
fair
a
enough.
Very successful college graduate.
Just looking at the issues surrounded with climate change and flooding, for me, being so far inland and being up in a high rise, I just kind of want to get your advice, I guess.
Yeah, well, the good thing here is a condominium, a high rise, you don't necessarily need flood insurance for your actual condominium, but you may need it for the building itself if you have monthly assessment fees in those common areas, a parking lot, and obviously your lobby. If those are in a flood zone, you're going to pay money in your monthly assessment for that, and you want to make sure you understand that. But frankly, the other risk there is during a flood event, can you get in and out of your condominium building? Maybe you're on the 12th, 15th, 20th floor. You don't have any risk of being flooded up there, but you're not going to be able to get to the building itself. So how good is the flood protection in the neighborhood? What do the seawalls look like or the stormwater sewers look like? All these kinds of wonderful questions, Melissa, that you never even think about until you decide to become a homeowner in Florida.
And I'm wondering, too, is your question more about the fact that since you're in Orlando and you're inland, you're not as worried maybe about flooding as you are about the long-term value of your property and your 30-year mortgage? Is that more your concern?
Yeah, necessarily. You guys are making really good points, it seems, with the limestone. And I just want to see kind of what your ideas are and how quickly Orlando, being so far inland and really being the center of the state, could be affected by something
sure.
like that.
Sure. Yeah. And I honestly don't have the answer to that. Our experts have signed off on for this hour, so we're now just taking calls. But, the projections range from really dire warnings to more moderate advice about how to look at your property value in the state of Florida. I would say, I'm not a scientist, obviously, but I would say because you're inland and because you're buying a condo without any land around it, you're probably in a little bit better position than folks living oceanfront. That would be my unscientific assessment of this.
Sure. The supply and demand of this, though, as climate refugees look for other places to go in Florida, they're immediately going to look into the middle of the state away from the coastline, in which case, Charles, as a new condominium buyer in Orlando, that may be a great purchase in the years ahead as more and more from South and Southwest Florida and other places along the coastline look to stay in Florida and look perhaps to become residents in your area in Orlando.
Well, Florida is synonymous with citrus. Florida oranges, grapefruits, and other fruits mean thousands of jobs and billions of dollars in revenue for this state. Citrus production remains down overall, but it is bouncing back from a tough couple of years. Growers who have managed to stick around as citrus greening disease ravaged their groves have been experimenting with different variations of trees, chemicals, and fertilizers. Some treatments are controversial.
And some are paying dividends here as production is beginning to rise again in some groves in Florida, in some orchards. So how is Florida's citrus industry adapting? How could the changes affect what we see in the grocery store as consumers? And how important is citrus? Certainly, it's a big past of Florida's history. But what about Florida's future? 305-995-1800. 305-995-1800. Maybe you work or live near a grove. Maybe you're a consumer and have seen some changes in the grocery store. You can join us on Twitter at Florida Roundup. Quentin Rowe is along with us via FaceTime. He's president of William G. Rowe and Sons, a grower in Winter Haven. Quentin, you're out in the orchards today. How's the season been for you?
We're just wrapping up our season this week. Packed our last oranges yesterday, so we're settling into a summer routine, which is basically growing the next year's crop and getting the equipment ready to go for another year.
Last couple of years have been awfully tough with this citrus greening. What was this year's crop like?
Greening we've been fighting now for 15-plus years, and it's been a horrible, debilitating disease for our industry. The Hurricane Irma 2 years ago was just absolutely a horrible blow. We had a pretty good recovery season, growing season coming into Hurricane Irma, and Hurricane Irma just, it was a 2-year event for everybody that's growing citrus. So we're coming, we just completed that 2nd year harvest off of Hurricane Irma, still fighting through the greening struggles, but there's a lot of optimism for a better year next year.
Let me ask you, Mr. Rowe, citrus farmers increasingly have been turning to bactericides, a sort of a novel form of pesticide, the same type of antibiotics that have been used to treat illnesses in people, being used now to treat the greening in Florida citrus. That has been controversial at the federal level. The EPA is allowing more of these chemicals, although the FDA and the CDC advise against it. Are you taking advantage of looser regulations for that to treat your citrus crop?
Greening is an interesting disease. It's actually a bacterium that clogs up the phloem in the tree. Now, I'll spare you the high school biology lesson. But the interesting thing about greening is it's causing the roots to starve, and so we're coming up with just a tremendous number of different methods of feeding the tree, actually feeding those roots that are atrophying up, or feeding the leaves directly with directly applied nutrients. Constant water so the tree is never in stress. Those are all valuable things. And we're learning over the last 10 years. The bactericides, while they've been used extensively in agriculture, whether it was protein or other types of agriculture for 50 years, it's a very, very small part of the solution for greening. It's not a cure-all. It's just another tool in the toolbox for us.
Speaking with Quentin Rowe, who is out amongst his trees. He's president of William G. Rowe & Sons, a citrus grower in Winter Haven. You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Andrew Jacobs is also with us. He is a reporter with the New York Times, joining us from the New York Times newsroom in New York City. Andrew was recently traveling and reporting on the citrus industry in Florida. And Andrew, specifically, you were looking at the use of chemicals and the regulatory changes that have happened. How has the Environmental Protection Agency changed how growers here in Florida and elsewhere can use chemicals?
Well, starting in 2016, the EPA allowed the use of two antibiotics on an emergency basis. And what happened this year, or actually in the end of last year, is they gave the green light to expand the use of one of those antibiotics for the rest of the country. And the other antibiotic is set to be approved as well for the entire country, all the growers. So that's sort of a big change, and it'll sort of dramatically increase the number of acres that farmers can use these drugs.
And Andrew, as farmers are increasing the use of these chemicals, as you write in the New York Times, there are concerns about the potential downstream impact to human health. Can you explain why?
Yeah, so when you use antibiotics out in the environment, or when you just generally overuse them, you increase the potential for bacteria to mutate and to become resistant to those drugs. So the fear is that if you spray fields with these antibiotics, you're going to not only cause sort of pathogenic bacteria in the soil that can harm humans, you can only cause that to mutate, but you also could, those bacteria can share their mutated ability to resist antibiotics with other bacteria. So there's a very wide spread concern among health experts about the overuse of these drugs.
And Quentin, how does that strike you as a citrus grower?
I guess anybody that's using antibiotics, whether you're using it as a human, whether you're using it in agriculture, everybody should be very aware and be very careful to use it in a limited and controlled way. And I think that's obvious. The biggest thing is for anybody that's using an antibiotic is you just need to be responsible. And it's got a place. Everything has a place in moderation.
How would you describe, Quentin, your use of these chemicals? You mentioned that you think that they're a relatively small tool within the toolbox that growers can and are using to battle citrus greening here in Florida. How about in your orchards? Have you utilized some of these chemicals, and what kind of results have you seen?
Like I said, they're a small tool in the toolbox, but an important tool. And to the extent that it can give your tree an extra chance to survive against greening and give you a chance to be productive as one of those tools, then it is important.
And if you're just tuning in, we're talking about Florida's citrus crop. Now, earlier we were talking about Florida real estate. They always say the three legs of the Florida economy are tourism, real estate, and agriculture. So we're covering all of it today on the show as we talk about threats to Florida citrus with citrus grower Quentin Rowe and also the New York Times. Andrew Jacobs, our reporter on the show today, we want your calls on the Florida Roundup. How important is citrus to Florida's future? Call us up right now at 305-995-1800. Tweets to @FloridaRoundup. More to come here on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. As we continue talking about challenges to Florida's citrus crop with citrus farmer Quentin Rowe of William G. Rowe & Sons in Winter Haven and Andrew Jacobs of the New York Times. We'll go to your calls in a moment on this. But first, Andrew, let me get into a little bit more of your reporting on this. As you report in the Times, the Obama administration gave temporary approval to these drugs, streptomycin and oxytetracycline. And so the Obama EPA said, we will allow these somewhat. And then under the Trump administration, much more broad, final, and expanded approval for the use of these compounds on citrus. And as you have reported, the EPA is at odds with other federal agencies on this. And can you explain a little bit more about that disconnect in Washington and how that's impacting the citrus crop here in Florida?
Well, it's been national policy for a few years to really focus on what they call antibiotic stewardship, where the government is oriented towards limiting the use of critical antibiotics that are important for human health in other uses. So the FDA and the CDC are very much involved in that effort. In 2017, the FDA banned the use of antibiotics as growth promoters in livestock, and that was a huge shift. So in this case, the EPA's proposed use of antibiotics really went against that initiative. And I think it upset people in those two other agencies. The bigger issue here, I think, is citrus greening has reached California. They have also have an enormous citrus industry. Mm-hmm. For now, it's limited to sort of backyard trees in around Los Angeles. But there's pretty much wide agreement that it's just a matter of time before it reaches the commercial groves. And when that happens, those farmers will, some of them, not all of them, will turn to these bacteriocides as well. So it's greatly expanding their use. So I think there's just sort of different philosophies in these different branches of government. The EPA, the pesticides office, is sort of more oriented towards industry, and CDC and FDA are sort of more focused on human health.
Hmm. Florida growers certainly have been battling citrus greening for 15 years, according to our guest, Quentin Rowe, who's along with us, the third-generation grower in Central Florida. Your phone calls and the citrus industry as a consumer, as a neighbor, maybe as a grower yourself. Ken in Largo on line three. Go ahead, Ken. You're on the radio.
Yeah, hi. I'm and my family own, as far as I know, the last commercial grove in Hillsborough County. We're in Odessa and in the northwestern corner of Hillsborough, and we could no longer do business the way we used to do it, which made, you know, broke even. This time last year, at the end of the season, I had 17 employees. Now it's me and one other fella. And of our 200 acres, probably only about 80 of them that we cultivated, and all we did was we mowed them and hand weeded them and let it rain on them. And we had a great crop.
So no chemical variety. Treatment, no additional nutrients in the soil, none of
now,
that.
We had cultivated in a, you know, very conventional way for many, many years. But we were just broke. I mean, and even when it wouldn't rain for 4 or 5 days, we didn't have, couldn't afford the diesel to run the pumps.
Yeah.
But even though we had a really good crop, when it came down to selling it, I had a really hard time finding buyers where I wasn't losing money. And what I was told by the larger packing houses, of course, most of the packing houses have closed, right? You know, that is from 80, 10 years ago, there's 19, I think. The prices were so low that we really, really almost couldn't afford to sell them, to pay the pickers. I was told that this was because the larger packing houses, in anticipation of a low yield in the Florida market, that they had contracted with overseas producers.
Interesting.
And they were filled up with the margins.
Gotcha. Ken, let me put that to Quentin Rowe, not only a grower, but Quentin, you also are running a packing house there at the family business. What do you say to Ken and his experiences?
There were a tremendous amount of imports this year. Southern hemispheres continued to grow a lot of soft tangerine varieties, and this last year they came in later than expected. The retailers stayed with them longer, and it very much got into Florida's traditional season. So it was a problem.
And you're listening to the Florida Roundup.
Not so much from a Packers.
Gotcha. And you're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. As we continue to take your calls about Florida's citrus crop, here's one from Victor in Tallahassee. He's got a question. Hey, Victor, you're on the air. Happy Friday to you. Go ahead, Victor. Are you with us?
So here's my question.
Yeah.
I also have a citrus in my backyard, but I'm not talking now about your EPA concern. I'm more. My question is about why are prices similar in Florida with other states when Florida is a citrus state? When you go to Walmart or any other shop.
The cost of citrus. Okay. Okay, let's ask our citrus farmer, Quentin Rowe, about the price point for Florida citrus. As you deal with challenges to the industry, how does that translate into the price consumers pay?
Citrus pricing is really demand-driven, right? So as we see product coming from California, and one of the things that happened to us this year was with the tariff war going on with China, a lot of California citrus that would have normally have gone export to China got dumped back into the United States. So
okay.
We saw really depressed pricing in the United States, and that flowed over into Florida too.
Interesting. So the trade war affecting our Florida citrus crops as well, Tom.
Yeah, you are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Andrew Jacobs with the New York Times. Let me ask you about the situation around price and what you experienced as you were doing your reporting around Central Florida with growers and how Florida Ag finds itself, frankly, at that intersection of international trade, not only with China, but also certainly with whatever is going to replace the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, in the months or years ahead. What do the growers tell you about price in the marketplace?
Well, actually, I found a lot of optimism. I expected there to be a lot of doom and gloom, and there is. A lot of people have gone out of business, but the growers are still hung on to this is actually a pretty good year. Prices are higher than they've been in a while. The yield is pretty good. I think, as you mentioned, the hurricane knocked things out for a few years. And then in addition to the bactericides, there's a lot of new things people are using, as the grower mentioned, this new sort of nutrients, watering, different things to sort of coddle the tree. So this is actually, there's a bit of a rebound, at least, you know, there was sort of a trough. So, I found, a fair amount of optimism in the sense, I think, is that these, you know, the hope is that these drugs will allow the trees to sort of hang on until something else comes
until
along.
Until something there is comes a lot of along that's being better. Yeah. Let me just try to get exactly in one more call. One more call. It's Karen in Riverview, Florida. Hi, Karen. You're on the air. Go ahead quickly.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
Yep. Go ahead.
Sorry. My name is Shari, and, you know, I'm not a grower, but I'm a consumer, and my concern about the antibiotics is huge. If Florida is just one big limestone, everything goes back out, you know, you flush the toilet, goes out into the ocean.
Yep.
I'm in the water industry. There's new technology out there that actually helps with horticulture and agriculture. It's part of, like, you know, something from NASA. And it helps the growth of trees, not necessarily the bugs, but it helps with the bacteria. And so there's got to be other natural solutions and other ways to help these farmers. I don't want to be buying out of country. I'd rather keep everything local.
I hear you. And we're almost out of time. So thank you for those points. Very quickly, Andrew Jacobs, can technology lead the citrus industry through this?
Absolutely. There's been a lot of those millions of dollars has been spent on this effort. And scientists are working on a sort of a genetically modified trees or just bred trees that are bred to resist this disease. So I do think you're going to see something in the next few years come through. I don't think it's the end of Florida's citrus industry.
And Quentin, what about the cost of that technology in terms of the end product and what the consumer pays?
There's no question that those costs will have to be passed along. There's very little margin left not to pass those costs along. But I do echo the feeling that there are solutions coming down the road, and we're optimistic about what those hold for the future.
Quentin, we'll let you get back to it there in the orchard in and around Winter Haven. Quentin Rowe taking some time out of his growing season, so to speak, as he's in between season, president of William G. Rowe & Sons, a third-generation citrus grower here in the Sunshine State. Quentin, thanks for sharing your experiences with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
And Andrew Jacobs, a reporter with the New York Times, with us from the newsroom in New York City. Andrew, thanks for coming and paying a visit with us here in Florida and your reporting on the issue of chemicals and citrus greening in the citrus industry.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Always some interesting conversations here, Melissa. As you mentioned, two of the three big tent poles that holds up the Florida economy today here on the Roundup, right? Real estate and agriculture.
That's right. And thanks to everyone who called and tweeted the show today as well, from wherever you are in the state. That is our show today. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Alex Gonzalez and Heather Schatz are producers.
Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming, WLRN's Director of Radio Operations, and our technical director this week is Peter Meritz. Engineering help from Doug Peterson. Our theme music provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at AaronLibos.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Have a safe, happy, and restful Memorial Day holiday. We'll be back here again at noon next Friday.